Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint. Today's guest really is radio and music royalty. He moved from MTV to BBC Radio 1 to host the first national radio show dedicated to R&B in 1996. And he's still bringing us his landmark show Rhythm Nation on Radio 2 four nights a week. I'm a fan and regular listener. I am, of course, talking about Trevor Nelson. On the cusp of his 60th birthday, this DJ shows no signs of slowing down. On top of weekly slots on Radio 2 and One Extra, he's headlining live music events up and down the country, curating and hosting Trevor Nelson's Soul Christmas, and championing R&B music worldwide. So maybe it's not surprising that he says he can't sit still. And that's why we're welcoming back Dr. Sarah Gilchrist, a high-performance consultant specialising in sleep and recovery, to chat about how you get a good night's sleep when you don't work a regular 9-to-5. Even though Trevor's a household name, who's interviewed some of the biggest stars, Beyoncé, Mariah Carey and James Brown, to name a few, I want to find out more about the hard work and dedication that made him the trailblazer he is today. So let's meet Trevor. Trevor Nelson, MBE, welcome to The Midpoint. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Gabby. Lovely to be with you on this podcast. And I'm, yeah, Midpoint is where I'm at.
You certainly are. And can I just say as well, for our regular Midpoint listeners, there's a new sound going on, and that is the sound of a Kenny Logan installed air conditioning unit, because where I record these podcasts is very high up in the house. And this week it is sweltering. So it's given me, if you don't mind me saying, a slight Mariah Carey-ness. There's a slight breeze blowing through my hair. It's got the wind machine, the plant behind. I could be kind of sat on some decking somewhere, just, you know, gently chewing the fat in the breeze, which gives us a different vibe to this podcast today, I think. Sun does that, doesn't it, Trevor?
You should never be doing your podcast at the top of your house, because the house I live in now, when I bought it, it's got a big loft that needs, you know, like when you're walking, oh, I could do something with that loft. He had an AC unit in there and I thought, what's he doing? And I got rid of it. And as the summer hit, oh my God, it's unlivable up there. So
but we did this. I did this up during the World Cup when I was in Qatar. So I was doing it remotely and instructing all the builders and what they were doing and everything. And my electrical specialist guy, he put a little heater in for me for the middle of winter. And he said, do you want some air conditioning for the summer? And I went, nah.
Open the window, it'd be good.
Well, of course, I was in Qatar. It was 38 degrees. I was thinking, well, and I was probably sat in an air-conditioned apartment, right, in Qatar, thinking, no, I'm cool. I'm really cool today. It's all good. Anyway, I'm here. You're here. We're enjoying the sunshine. I've got you late in the day because your working day starts a bit later because of your show, obviously. Talk me through kind of, I'm always fascinated to know people who work, as I see it, different shifts, you know, how your day works and how that works with your body clock.
Well, me and my partner, we're like ships in the night.
Works
she
well.
She comes home. She goes to bed when I'm going to work. and I suppose that's the longevity of our relationship. It makes it work. We're not in each other's faces too much. But no, I've always worked off-piste, if you know what I mean, time-wise. Mm. I've never done... I mean, 30 years ago, I did a 9-to-5. Since then, I've never done a 9-to-5. So I am now... I would leave home about 9, get to work about 9:30. I've been, just before I've started this podcast with you, I spent the last 3 hours doing playlists because I playlist all my songs on my shows. So that takes up half my day, to be fair. And I've just had, they've just left 7 years in the same house, Gabby, internet, terrible. They've just come in and hardwired me. So as soon as I get off, I am running around like a child, right? Literally testing every room. Oh, it's going to be joyful. It's going to be like...
We got you just at the right time then. This internet connection is beautiful.
Really,
it's beautiful.
Really good mood. And you've got the best internet. You're the first person to test my internet, my name.
And you moved, if my research is correct, you've moved to the burbs. You moved out of town. moved a little bit further out a few years ago. You know, you think of, and we'll talk a bit about this, about DJs and kind of the aging process, how you stay relevant to your audience and how you kind of stay relevant to your music. Did that feel like a big psychological move? Because I think you're at, were you Shoreditch or somewhere super trendy in the
yeah.
town?
Yeah. I was trendy, but I wasn't trendy. Do you know what I mean? I grew up loving, I tell you, my spot was Camden Town, where I wish I was born, brought up, lived. It, you know, in my sort of teenage years, that was where I went. I went to Electric Ballroom every Friday night. It was my first club. I loved all the bars in Camden. I loved the whole vibe of Camden. I just wanted to live in Camden. We did pirate radio, Kiss FM in Camden. You know, we did warehouse parties in Camden. We, you know, people knew where we were and they didn't grass us up because we were part of that Camden clique. You know what I mean? And Camden now to me is just sort of like a flea market for tourists. You know, that's what it feels like now. And then it's all shifted to Old Street, Shoreditch. So when I was in Old Street and Shoreditch, well, Clerkenwell, sort of in between Clerkenwell and Old Street, it was cool to be there, but I'm not cool. I didn't want to be cool. I didn't want to step out of my house and loads of young people walking past and being cool and getting excited. I thought, I'm in the wrong place. This isn't for me. You know, so it was a constant reminder that you're in the middle of life. Now, when I was 18, that would have been a dream. But not when you enter a middle age. It wasn't, you know, it was great for that property prices, but not for my mental
state. It lost
state
its luster then. A little bit.
Yes. There was no zen about it.
So you then, you got yourself a dog as well in the last few years.
Yeah.
So you kind of entered a lot of the adult kind of things that people do, maybe a little bit later, because people kind of move out, don't they? When they get, sometimes it's when they have kids, sometimes it's when, and I'm not saying just London, but people do that in the big cities, don't they? They want to move out. You've probably done it a little bit later. Do you think that was because of, obviously you mentioned work and what you're doing and having your finger on the pulse with music and gigs and DJing? It's really in town, isn't it? They're in towns, those things that you do.
Yeah, it's really difficult to explain to people who don't do a regular sort of 9 to 5 how you can't have things like pets. You just can't because, you know, it's no point being in Ibiza one night, coming back, you might miss the flight, you know, you just don't know. You can't have people, oh, keep hold of the dog. I've just missed a flight because, oh, it's the planes. No, well, I drank too much last night. Yeah, you've got to be responsible. And having a dog is more than like having a child. I cannot believe I've never had a dog, Gabby, until now. I genuinely am in love with my dog. And he is wonderful. I've got fish as well. And
what's
cat.
The dog called? Let's name the dog.
The dog's named Ollie.
Ollie.
After a dear friend of mine who passed away a few years ago, but he was one of my favourite friends in the Caribbean. And, you know, I just thought as a tribute to him, I named my dog Ollie because I love him unconditionally, my dog. So, and I love my old mate. So, yeah, you know, and he's a Cavapoo, not my choice. I wanted a proper dog like a Labrador or something like that. But the missus had her heart set on a Cavapoo. And the thing about Cavapoos, when you know, we were trying to get one in lockdown, obviously, but we wanted one before, they doubled their price.
Yes, they did. They went insane, didn't they, in lockdown? It's very valuable. And so do you, when you look at what your life is like now compared to the 30-year-old you, does it feel, I mean, you're 60 next year. You look incredible. We'll get onto that in a moment. But, you know, you're 60 next year. And yet when I listen to you on the radio, and you're playing tunes that I want to hear, and you know your show is brilliant, and you can, you know, you just saying then that you spend half a day on your playlist, you can see, you know, you can hear that in the proof is in the pudding. Can you believe, you know, what your life was like and what your life is like now, and yet you're still kind of doing it? You're doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's very different though. I'm at 30. I was on Radio 1. I was at a record label. I was hungry. I was working so hard. I was nervous. My life wasn't in my own hands. I thought I'd have 5 years. You know all those things. You know, I look at your career in a similar way. You know that you just don't, you cannot plan your future because it's in the hands of others all the time. And the competition is constantly coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, and then when someone says, you coming to my barbecue? No, I've got stuff to do. You shut down all your social stuff. I didn't enjoy life at 30. I enjoyed the job, But I didn't, I suppose I was up for the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I was doing good stuff. And I felt I was doing, you know, I had ethics and I had all this stuff. And I saw people around me who didn't. And they were flying past me to a certain degree, you know, and I was thinking.
But they were flying and crashing, maybe, were they? Were they zooming past you and then crashing a bit?
Yeah, maybe eventually crashing. But, you know, DJs would be bigger than me. People on TV, I'd be doing MTV, someone would be doing Channel 4. You know, yeah, it depends what you want out of life. I decided that I was happy with where I was. And the one thing I worked at 30, I really worked hard at, was not being envious. It's really difficult when you get in the media not to look at somebody else and think, why is that person doing that and I'm not? You know,
that when did you get that, Trevor? Because that's a really big life skill, you know, in a really competitive industry.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, being a minority back then was always, although people talk about it now and people don't get why people harking on about being a minority so much, enjoy your life. Well, back then, there were so few of us that were doing national radio, doing TV, doing stuff like that, that you couldn't really be envious. You felt that you were a bit trailblazy, you know. I felt, I mean, I'm on Radio 1 doing the first ever R&B show, you know. I've got to keep this going. It wasn't like I was looking over my shoulder going, oh, he's coming up or she's coming up. It was just me, you know what I mean, to a certain degree. But when you move to TV, it's different. It was like a... You've got to want telly. You've really got to want telly to do telly, I think. You can't sort of just go on and go, okay, today's telly, yesterday was radio. No, you've got to want it. And at times I watched things and I thought, why aren't I doing that? And I thought, I shook myself and said, no, don't think like that. Be happy with what you've got and work on what you've got, because I saw so many people chasing a dream that wasn't really their dream. I don't think they were really that focused on what they wanted to do. They just wanted to be bigger. And bigger and more famous, and they'll take on any, and you end up taking on gigs that you aren't suited for, or, you know, an agent says to you, you should do that. You've got to be really your own person and focus and say no. Being able to say no is so powerful. And I decided a long, long time ago, I'm not going to chase Saturday night television or be that person. I'm going to be in my own lane and be the best I can be with what I've got. And in the end, I've got this longevity because of that. I really believe that, because I think it's better to be good at one thing or two things than try to be great at 10 things, which is the norm nowadays.
Mm. Everybody is supposed to be able to turn their hand to anything. But what you're saying there as well is so wise. Did you have counsel? Did you have people who gave you that kind of advice? Because as you say, agents... You know, particularly, I think in the 90s, there was a go, try this, do this. There's lots of TV stations were opening up, new radio, digital. It was all kind of expanding. There seemed to be more jobs and more things to do. So to keep really deep in an area and specialists like that, that takes a bit of willpower, really.
I think you do it yourself. I don't think you need people around. I didn't have people around me because no one had done what I was doing. You know, you can't have people giving you advice who had never walked the walk. You can have people who have opinions on what you're doing, but, you know, they've not walked your walk. You know, they've not had to sit in meetings where people don't really get it, but you understand why they don't get it. So you've got to compensate for them not getting it. You know what I mean? It's very difficult to explain, but I think the seismic change for me was at 30. All I cared about was just keep working. I mean, I must have worked 6-7 days a week when I was 30, definitely, which I looked older at 30 than I do now because I was getting no sleep.
You were just more
tired.
Yeah, can I just go back to something you said about being a trailblazer? Because I was looking at your career and I'm glad you said that, because I was thinking, should Trevor Nelson have had a more high profile show earlier on Radio 2 or Radio 1, were it not for the fact that he was a trailblazer in terms of the colour of his skin, and there were not many black DJs 35, 40 years ago on national radio stations. Did you ever feel like, because what you've talked about now is your niche actually is what's keeping you so relevant and, you know, still at the heartbeat of one of the biggest stations in the country. Was there ever feeling inside you though that actually I would like the breakfast show on Radio 1? I would like the, you know, drive time show.
No, I'm not going to sit here and say ever it was down to the colour of my skin or anything. I got opportunities I didn't take. My boss at Radio 1, he was at the time, Andy Parfitt, he was a very, very wise person, like people person. He was clever. He was very likable. And he invited me around his house once. And I went round and I remember we were shooting the breeze a little bit, and he always had an agenda. Instead of asking me, would I like to do daytime? He wanted to know, you know, like that thing where they say, guess what I've got for you? He wouldn't ask me, so I'd shut him down. He left the door ajar. He wanted to hear me say, I'd like to do a daytime show. But my problem was, Gabby, I represented a style of music that if I jumped ship from doing specialist R&B, hip hop, and that sort of stuff, and I ended up playing Britney, you know, Oasis, and whatever was the music of the day, all of those people that followed me would go, he just wants to be famous. He's not truly into his R&B and hip hop. He's not our guy. So you have to sacrifice the ability, you know, your potential to be a much bigger person. And, you know, I can't complain. I also had a similar thing with BBC television. I had a friend who was one of the key guys who started Strictly Come Dancing. May he rest in peace as well. He worked with Mick Kiss FM, and he called me up to the BBC, and he said, what do you want to do? Do you fancy Saturday night television? And I remember at the time Ian Wright had just done a stint on Saturday night. Do you remember that?
Yeah, he had the show. Yeah, yeah.
And he was, yeah, and I felt they're not using Ian Wright the right way. Ian was excited about doing it, obviously. I mean, a footballer doing a Saturday night show interviewing Elton John is huge. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you go back and you ask Ian, he'd say, well, I'm better suited to do it now than I was then. I didn't want to do that. For all the money it gives you and everything, I just felt, so I did get the opportunities in a way. I was invited. I simply said, I can't do it. I can't go out of my lane and be ambitious for ambitious sake. I felt at the time, are you mad? Who would possibly turn this down? You know, but I felt a fraud if I did it.
And you obviously had such love for the music that you were playing and the music you were DJing. And also, you know, let's not forget, this is the time mega DJs earning a lot of money, going out, as you mentioned earlier, to Ibiza, flying around the world DJing. So in terms of the sacrifice for the fame, actually wasn't a sacrifice for the finances, was it? Because you were still able to presumably earn a really great living. So you were able to pursue your passion and continue to, you know, to be in a very lucrative area of the world of broadcasting and entertainment.
Yeah, there were lots of DJs who earned far more than me and far, far wealthier than I am. I remember I play R&B. That's small club music. That's not 10,000 people. You know, there are so many huge DJs that you don't see at all. I mean, they are living in Malibu. They're living in, you know, the Carl Coxes of this world, huge, you know, I mean, good luck to them.
And even that didn't tempt you?
No, I could have, do you know, Gabby, at the time when Kiss was a pirate radio station and we became legal in 1990, a lot of DJs made the choice to play dance music because they knew that was the music that was good. That's what kids wanted. That's what's going to make you a big star. And a few of us, a handful of us, stuck with our soul and R&B. And I remember when I joined Radio 1, I was still playing in clubs that held 200 people, while my contemporaries were in Ibiza playing to 10,000 people, you know, and that is just, but people to this very day still talk about those clubs, and that's important to me.
And have your audience grown with you? You know, your Radio 2 audience, and obviously that's a certain demographic, but do you see, when you do DJ and you see who's listening to your music now, or you know who's listening to your shows, I mean, you play a real mix, don't you, on your Radio 2 show? You play some new stuff, you play some old classics. Do you know that there are younger people who are getting their R&B education from you?
Yeah, I'm fully aware. I think the one thing I know is my audience. And I think that when you go to a station, you have to do a show that's right for the station. People love to say things like, I mean, I can tell you've listened, right, from what you've said so far. But, you know, people, I went to Radio 2, I remember, and I remember saying to myself, you know, they've never had a show like mine, so I can't expect them to have people who understand what I'm playing. but I can do a show for them because it's at the right time of night. I'm the right voice at that time of night. The music I like suits that time of night. And I remember going and saying, doing my 5 seconds to name quiz and saying, when you send your answer in, tell me who your favourite band is or your favourite act is. And be honest, I got Def Leppard, I got Led Zeppelin, I got I didn't get Otis Redding, I didn't get Beyonce, I didn't get Shalimar. You know, I got 1 in 10 was a genuine soul act. And yet they were listening. And this is what I said to my producer. Yeah, look at this. And she was like, oh, my God. And I said, I don't play any of this music. And I said, but they're listening. They're listening. So that's their favourite band, but yet they're listening to me playing, I don't know, Georgia Smith or Drake or something. And I said, there's something in
this. I love that new Georgia Smith. You played it a few times, amazing. That new Georgia Smith song. Oh, and I was going to talk to you about that, actually, about giving a prescription for somebody like me, who I'm fully aware that I can get into a rut. And I'm sure a lot of midlifers will recognise this, right, where you keep playing the same stuff. Right. You listen to a show like yours, yeah. Or you might be driving along and you hear a song, you're like, then you get home and you've forgotten the song because your memory's full because you're 50 years old. And then you hear it again and you go, oh yeah, I must download that song. And I think, well, what you can do presumably is go and look at your playlists that you do for your shows and hopefully get those downloaded. But you need to do prescriptions, I think, for people, you know, like, what are your favorite songs? And you could make a fortune. It could be like, what was that? Was it Cameo, that thing where people used to record messages? You could do like somebody's birthday top 10 prescription, new songs that I should be listening to or that you should be listening to.
I think so. But I do believe, as middle-aged people, I have a theory that most of my audience have checked out new musically. You know, they don't buy new music or care to stream new music. It's just filling for them. So I actually treat new music on my show as a bridge. So I'll play, say I play the Isley Brothers. Who's that lady? Who's that lady? And you're humming along. I know this song. And then I play George Smith. And unless you're truly invested, you won't even remember who it was I've just played. Unless you're invested. But the hope in my head is that someone like you goes, oh, I really like that Georgia Smith you're playing. So if you hear something you like that's new, you're willing let it enter your mind and ruminate a bit and just go, oh, if he plays it again and again.
And we talk about this about midlife as a lot, that you need to keep learning and you need to keep refreshing your brain with whatever it is, your passions, and not just shut your life down, whether it's, I only read this kind of book, I only watch this kind of TV, I only listen to this kind of music. You know, I know what I like now. And I'm really mindful that perhaps music is one of the areas that I'm least adventurous. Do you know what I mean?
But I don't blame you. Everything that's set out for you out there is to play hits that you know. Every radio station will play hits that make you comfortable. I argue with my partner all the time. When we get in the car, she listens to a certain radio station that I used to be a part of many years ago that I helped start. And I say to her, I know what they're going to play. She goes, I don't care. I'm driving for 15 minutes. I need a fix. I'll bring you flowers. You know what? And then I go, I bet I know what's coming next. And, you know, we have this game, but she's happy. I have to force her to listen to my show. So, well, she's asleep anyway, so she listens again. But I do understand why midlifers are set in their ways, like what they like. But there are midlifers out there that I see, I still DJ every other week, who come out, party like they don't care, and are just full of life and amazing people. I'm so glad I still DJ because I meet the most amazing people, Gabby. Honestly, they are full of beans. They're like, their kids are grown. Shackles are grown. And they're different animals. They're worse than they were when they were young.
Well, I've got parties the next 2 weekends. And the thing I'm, as well as getting dressed up and everything, one of the things I'm looking forward to is the music and the bands, because I know I'll probably dance for like 3 hours because I don't go to nightclubs anymore, right? So I don't get to dance. So it's parties really is where you kind of end up dancing. And then afterwards, you know, you think, oh, I need to do that more. I need to do more of that. Because, you never feel bad, do you, when you've heard great music for 3 hours and you've been dancing? You just don't. It's such an unbelievable hit of endorphins.
But you're also not standing there seeing if you're being checked out by somebody, like when you were a kid, like when you were younger. You know, I joke about this all the time. I get on the microphone and I say to people, oh, how are you doing? Sort of thing. And they were like, hey. And I say, yeah, babysitter's in or da-da-da-da or whatever, whatever. Do you remember when you used to come out and you and it'd be in their local town? Because I always like going around. I don't like people having to travel. I travel to you. So I go, remember you used to go to a club and there's always someone in the club you cannot stand. Oh, she's here or he's here. Oh, I better stay in this corner. Or, you know, he's a pest. He's going to pest you. Now we don't care. We dance, we sweat, we don't care what we look like so much. Some people do. Some people don't care how they dress. They've lost their sense of fashion. They don't care. They're here to have a great time. And it's so different, the energy. And I am actually enjoying DJing now more than I ever did. And that is not even a lie. I love it. I hate the travel, hate the hotels, hate not being at home on a Sunday morning. But once I'm on that stage and I see the love, it's mad. It's crazy. It's just,
so what are the venues you're DJing in? Are these clubs where they're attracting a more, let's say, a plus 30 crowd then?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I won't do clubs. I don't
right,
do
so
clubs.
Where, so what are the venues then?
Has to be a live music venue.
Right.
Has to be a live music venue. I don't believe mums and dads go to venues that their kids go to.
No.
They don't want to be seen dead in there. So
no.
It's got to be a live
music. It doesn't work for either side.
No, at all. You don't want to be seen walking in some glitzy place called Benji's or something like that. No. So I go into venues. The thing about these venues is they stand up. You stand up, you see a band. So you stand up and I'm there. The sound's always really good. And I don't have to walk through the crowd, which is, I get traumatized walking through a crowd. I really do. I still
like
get
to come
nervous.
From backstage.
Yes, I don't like walking through a crowd and people, I don't know, I just don't like it. I prefer to just be on stage and orchestrate and people watch, which is the best thing ever, people watching. I mean, it's always been the best seat in the house. People making fools of themselves, people just being inappropriate, people trying to dance like they used to 20 years ago and they can't get up.
Pulling a disc.
They can get down. But they can't get up. It's like you see them crawling up like, I'm here. And I said, Jesus, get low again. Oh, cockades. It's hilarious. It's so funny.
And do you think this keeps you young, Trevor? Do you think this keeps your spirit young?
I think so. And I think, and I'm not deliberately trying to stay young, but it just, you just, you've got joie de vivre, you know what I mean? You've got, and these people, you bounce off them, and they look at you and they'd say, I've still got life. Look at me. I'm still alive. It's almost like they're holding placards going, I'm alive. I'm here. I say, who's staying till the lights come on? Me. You know, it's really. Cliff Richard once said, I remember when I was younger, I remember him doing interviews and I remember going, oh, gosh. When he said things like, oh, my fans, mum's daughters. I was like, shut up, Cliff. I was like, oh, and now I'm saying it. And now I'm saying mums and daughters come to my gigs and I'm just like, oh my God, I'm turning into Cliff.
But you're grateful. I mean, I think, do you not think you get to an age where you go, well, I'm just grateful that you are here because I don't care who it is. I'm glad that you're involved and you're enjoying yourself and you're making people smile. Now you said yourself that you think you look better now than you did when you were 30 and you look 30 sitting here on this screen. You've just said your internet might be dodgy, but it's not dodgy that it takes years off you. So, and you also, I read a quote from you saying, it's not a case of black don't crack. It's a case of we wear more moisture. There's something along those lines that you're basically saying about black skin. And I can't say that, but you can say that. So, but your skin is either very well moisturized or you've got a secret to tell us.
No, I generally think I don't moisturize much. I don't really do that much. But the number one thing is, if you don't moisturize your hands, Gabby, I won't be able to tell. If I don't, it looks like the Gobi Desert. You can see, we call it ashiness. We've got no choice. We have ashy knees, ashy elbows. So we have to moisturize. But I think we're blessed. A lot of us are very, very fortunate that the reason I say I look younger now than I did then is only because I never slept then. And my eyes were constantly red and tired and I thought I was Superman. Whereas now I make sure I get minimum six. And six, I can function on six.
You should be getting seven really, shouldn't you?
No, I mean, in an ideal world, but when you've got a missus who goes to bed at 10, honestly, and wakes up at 6 every morning, it's really, and the moment you even if you're wearing socks and you go into the bedroom, any slight movement. I was joking with my friends, like, actually, JJ, who lives around the corner, he does one show. He lives near me, and we play golf.
Jermaine,
yeah, we're good friends. And we went out with our partners to dinner, and we were chatting away, and we were saying, I said to him, you know, coming into the house, I put my phone torch on, and I don't put the lights on, and I sneak around the bedroom. And he said, I do exactly the same. And we it was hilarious. And our partners are, you know, sitting opposite, just laughing. And I'm going, I mean, even a slight movement and she's moving. And we creep into bed. And he's telling me his techniques for getting undressed so she can't hear. And then he dropped the bomb on me, which is the funniest thing. I said, and father's using the toilet because, like, he goes, why don't you sit down? And I'm like, God, all these years.
Well, do you know, that's how I know my husband's come in normally, because his wedding ring, and I've worked out what it was, he does sit down, but then he obviously rests his hand on the toilet seat, and I can hear his wedding ring clinking, and I never knew what that's. And then one night I was like, it's his wedding ring. I mean, I'm glad that he comes in wearing his wedding ring. Obviously, that's a bonus. But I'm very good at kind of, there's like a little dressing room off the bedroom, so he gets stripped off in there, goes through to the toilet. The automatic light comes on in the bathroom when he's in there, so I can see the chink of light. And I do wake up, but I get back to sleep really quickly. I don't even check the time. You know what I mean? It could be 4 a.m. I've got no idea what the time is.
I don't want to check the time. You don't want to check. But it's the same thing. I get changed in the bathroom. We all do the same thing. There's a pattern, and there's a male-female pattern, I think. I remember saying to my mates, I bumped into a load of mates because we did a big thing at the Royal Albert Hall on Friday just gone, which was really good for Windrush.
Oh, that looked amazing. I saw that on Denise Lewis's social media as well. It looked amazing.
Did Denise go?
Yeah, Denise was
did
there.
Did she go? Yeah. I'm so glad she went. But it was so good. It was so... I had some of my most hyper... You know, you've got critical friends when you say... you know, like, say you've done a show on TV game and you go, what was I like, honestly? And you've got a friend who will tell you. Mm-hmm. Not an agent, a friend. No, what are you wearing, Gabby? That wasn't right. You didn't look great. You go, oh, fair enough. Well, I had all of them there, and they all came back. We're having a laugh, and we all look similar. We all look good for our age and stuff. And then we broke it down, and then I said to my mate, yeah, so after this, the thing about this, it's been a fantastic night. I mean, I'm buzzing, but I'm going home to watch a Discovery Channel. Any random documentary on at 3 a.m. And then he said, that's what I do. And then he said, did you know there was this emperor that was, and he Googled the guy. And I keep meeting my mates who I think are super cool, and they all do the same thing. They watch war documentaries. They watch anything into the... Does your husband do that? Please tell me he does.
No, I think he genuinely will be coming straight in and coming to bed because he wants... Because in the morning, I don't know what your partner's like, he'll have to get up at the same time as me. So I'm not like going to creep up in the morning. I'll be like, right, everybody, curtains open. So I think he wants to get sleep as quickly as possible. But we would do that. If we came in late from somewhere, we would definitely start watching some nonsense documentary or something that that you're thinking, it's 3 a.m, I need to turn the TV off now. But like, isn't that the joy of midlife? You can come in and do that and not feel you have to be carrying on at the party somewhere or going to the after
party.
Club.
I don't know what that means, an after party.
Let's bring in Sarah Gilchrist, who is an expert in sleep and athletic performance. We touched upon sleep there, so I think it's a good time to just get our expert today on the podcast. Hello, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I was enjoying your conversation.
Oh, good. Hi, Sarah. Good. Sarah, you heard there that Trevor is a late sleeper because of his show. He gets to bed a bit later. He's getting 6 hours sleep at the moment, which he seems to be happy with. And I think it's really important as well to actually address shift workers, because he can't change when his show is, right? It's that time of the day. So he's not going to be going to bed at 10:30 with his partner. And a lot of people listening to this will also have those kind of random shift patterns. And I always feel for those people, because when sleep advice is given, it's always get to bed at a regular time, you know, try and do it before 11, don't be in front of screens and all that kind of thing. Sorry, go on, Trevor, you're going
to
come in.
Can I add one thing to that before you answer, Sarah? Also, adrenaline. Okay, depending on what you do for a living, all right? Now, if you're an accountant and you're working late, I don't think you get home with an adrenaline bus to come down from. But when you're talking, when you're playing music to the nation or you've come in from a gig, it's very hard to go straight to bed and say, right, I need sleep. Because what about me? What about me for a couple of hours winding down? What about me decompressing? So that
totally.
I always...
Even when I do Match of the Day and I'd finish on air at midnight in Salford and I get home at 3 a.m. afterwards, and when I get in, I still feel I need another hour to decompress. And that's really, that's hard, Sarah, isn't it? Because you can't, you know, kind of accelerate decompression.
No, you can't. And it, I mean, sleep is individualized, just to your point on the 6 hours, Trevor, if that works for you. That works for you. 7 to 9 is the guide, but some people are 6, some people are 10. But that decompression, particularly after doing something like that, where the adrenaline's pumping, it's like people that do exercise in the evening because that's where they can fit it in around work and then come home. You don't kick your trainers off and get straight into bed. The key then is to sacrifice the quantity and then have quality sleep. So you might have less sleep that evening, but you've decompressed. So when you do go to bed, you're in a state of mind that you can fall asleep rather than be buzzing from being on national radio or doing whatever it is you've been doing. The difference with you, Trevor, is it's something you do most nights of the week. So it's not one night of the week. And that's where with shift work in particular is that it becomes a lifestyle choice. It's not a job. It's a way of living, and that you incorporate the job into your lifestyle. And then that's an easier way to manage. And when you're not working those hours, if you have time off, if you're on holiday or you have a break from that, it's the time to get back onto a really good sleep routine, a normal, in inverted commas, sleep routine.
Can you do that, Trevor?
No. Sorry, Sarah, I was going to interrupt you. Thank you for interrupting, Gabby, because I was going to shut you down right there, Sarah. When I go on holiday, it's murder. It's horrible. I love the. We go on holiday, but we have a home in St. Lucia. We go there. We look forward to it. It's, what's the time difference? It's 5 or 6 hours different. So 9 o'clock in St. Lucia is 2 o'clock our time.
Mm.
And they'll be ready to just, she'll be out like a light. I cannot sleep for love nor money on holiday. It takes me, we'll go away for 10 days. Day 7, I'll be all right. And then we're coming home. It's so difficult. It's been like this.
You get a desynchronization of what's called your circadian rhythm, your internal body clock, which you have many, and sleep is one of your biggest drivers of that. You've entrained yourself, and it also might be your chronotype. It may be that actually you're an evening person anyway, which is why you do the job you do. You know, you're naturally born to do your DJing, or did you entrain into it because you love the job? But then also you're combining that with a flight, and then you're combining that with the time difference. So if you went for 3 weeks a month, that would change. So that might be quite nice to be in St. Lucia for 3 weeks or a month, but not everyone can't do that.
I always feel for when you read, and I read a lot about, you know, kind of life advice regarding sleep and what people should be doing. And it always does kind of be quite prescriptive for people who lead regular lives. And that shift workers who work through the night, you know, doctors, nurses who have to do night shifts till 6, 7 in the morning, must read that stuff and feel like, well, I'm going to have a shorter life because this is all linked to longevity, isn't it? You know, and, you know, that must feel pretty hard to think, well, I'm doing a job, actually, if you're a doctor or a nurse or a fireman, you know, you're doing vital work and you're actually potentially shortening the length of your life doing that. What can people do to hack into that? Is there anything that you recommend from a supplementary point of view or anything else lifestyle-wise?
Globally it's changed. Education of employers and employees has helped. So where possible, having, like, talk about lifestyle. So rather than the vending machines, you have healthy food. People on shift work, because your appetite, the hormones related to your appetite are affected if you're awake in the night, you're more likely to want the pizza. But if they've got the choice of having healthier food options, and on the whole can do that. But it's the lifestyle side of things. So making sure when they're off shift that they can get the sleep that they need, the family are around that, you know, so the house is quiet when they need to sleep, all those kinds of things, so that they're doing what they need to do on shift. Napping can be good if you've got the circumstances, the motivation, the opportunity to nap at a correct time.
Are you a napper, Trevor? Are you a napper?
Me? Involuntary, yeah. When I'm watching something I really like, I'll fall asleep. If I'm actually invested in something, well, the other day I was doing yesterday even, I had the laptop on, I was listening to new music, and I was gone. And it was because I was listening carefully to the song. If I'm not really involved, I don't nap. If I'm really involved, I nap.
You're concentrating when you're really focused.
Yeah, which worries me when I'm driving, because I'm really concentrating when I'm driving. So I'm thinking, but I have to say, Sarah, I've been going to work some nights and I've yawned my way through Regent's Park, which really worries me. I get within 5 minutes of work and I've yawned six times and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Do you ever nap before work? Do you have a tap?
No, I can't force it. Anytime I make an environment perfect for sleep, I don't sleep. If I'm not meant to sleep, I will probably nap.
When you get to work, Trevor, does the adrenaline start pumping and that's kind of what gets you through?
The moment I walk through the door, the yawns stop. I don't know what goes on with my head because it's just, you wouldn't know I was yawning. I'm absolutely fine. It's just weird. I genuinely believe, Sarah, you can't help me because I used to work, I used to have an office in Kentish Town and there was next door to me was a sleep therapist. And he had a place in Harley Street. So I went up to him and I went, can you help me? This is 20 years ago. Gave me a diary. He gave me something to, you know, everything. And I just couldn't keep up with it. I couldn't do it. I said, I don't think anyone can help me.
Then that's the thing. Do you need the help? Because you're saying you get 6 hours, you feel good, you look better than you did when you were 30, all this kind of stuff, and you're delivering on the show. If you're refreshed, fully productive, at work and on the whole in the working day, then the chances are you're getting enough sleep. And there is this aspect of entraining yourself into the environment in which you work and sleep. So I used to work with elite rowers. They have to be up very early in the morning. Were they all early risers in the morning? Were they, if they were left to sleep naturally? Probably not. But did they entrain into it? Or actually were the elite ones the larks? Naturally were they larks? Same with swimmers or canoeists who get up early. So you entrain into a certain way of sleeping. You've been doing it a long time. And then so you're kind of used to it and your body, your job involves adrenaline. So there's lots of chemical influences to the role that you do that physiologically make you alert.
You touched on something that I've thought about a lot and I've never got professional advice on this. I like to keep healthy if possible. So my do you know the way I do it? Because I'm not a member of a gym. I've got bits of equipment at my house. So what I do, I've got a little golf screen in the garage. So what I do, I put a couple of weights in there and some bands. I have some in the bedroom. I have positioned around the house as a constant reminder, do something you lazy git, right? So what I do in between golf shots, I'll do some reps. So I'll play a hole, which takes about a couple of minutes, and then I'll do some reps. And I'll do, you know, and I started thinking, look, if you can't sleep, that's okay, it works for me. But if you can't sleep and you're getting at 1:30, why not exercise? And I hear a lot of people exercise late at night. Maybe that will knacker me out and I'll fall asleep. But you give me the impression that your adrenaline kicks in more, it might hurt your sleep.
It depends on the type of exercise you're doing. If you're there with a TheraBand and it's some stretching and all that kind of stuff, then that's not going to give you any more adrenaline than running a national show on radio. And some golf swings, you know, as long as you're not getting frustrated with your golf swing and getting yourself worked, it depends.
You know, golf, you must play golf. You must play golf. You said that.
What about magnesium? Do you take magnesium, Trevor?
Yes, I've got magnesium, but I haven't been taking it. And I don't. A physio recommended I take magnesium, and it was more for muscular, you know, reasons or something.
Well, magnesium is used by the body for a whole host of recovery processes, which is why it's one of the reasons that the theories is around the fact that it can help with sleep. But you play golf, so you must access daylight on a fairly regular basis around the fact that you work indoors late at night, and that can help with sleep as well. So if you've accessed the daylight, we usually say in the first third of the day, but obviously with your sleep patterns, that might not be possible. But if you're accessing daylight on a regular basis, you're relatively healthy in terms of your nutrition and you're doing some sort of physical activity. I don't say exercise because people think I mean they have to be training for a marathon. It doesn't have to be that. It can be walking the dog. It can be, like you say, TheraBands, whatever, golf swings in the garage, whatever it is. And then, you know, you are in a routine, you're asleep. Yes, you're working late, but you are in a routine. It's not like you're doing Tuesday and Thursday nights and then the odd Saturday. It's like, it's a regular show. So you're in a routine and in a rhythm. And then where possible, you're valuing your sleep, protecting it, prioritising it. And you're saying you're regularly getting that sleep.
Yeah, and it's good deep sleep. It's good deep sleep. Yeah, I don't wake up in the middle of the night, in the middle of my sleep. It's good deep sleep. I wake up and I'm pretty groggy when I wake up until I've had my coffee or porridge. And
and you're not having caffeine late during your show when you're on
no.
air?
No. Well, I have as a routine ritual, because I've got to have something. You've got to be a diva a little bit when you do something, else they don't respect you. You know what I mean? You know, Gabby,
what you're talking about. So what do you have, Moe?
Get in there. Now I get in and I have a ginger tea with honey.
Nice.
A little bit of honey. And I say to my team, it's for my voice. It's not. I just want them to do something for me. But it's, I have a little gulp. I suppose it helps. And I don't see that as any. It's only a little
that's
bit.
All, that's all. It sounds like it's all good, Sarah, doesn't it? And Trevor's doing some good practice. Anybody listening who's doing shift work, there's a lot of stuff to take away from what Trevor's doing there. So what would your, before we lose you, your top three tips for somebody at the moment? I think you've kind of alluded to a few of them there. But if you were just to up some for us, Sarah.
Working shifts, it's a lifestyle choice, so you have to incorporate it into the whole of your life. It's not just something that's separate to the rest of what's in your life, whether it's walking the dog, family life. It has to be part of it. And I know you'll say people have told you this, Trevor, and it doesn't work for you, but it physiologically getting back onto a routine when you are off shift. So if you're working traditional shifts in terms of doctor, paramedic, whatever, you have that 10-12 day period where you can get back into a routine, will help in the long term physiologically. And then remembering it's an individualized approach. What works for you? Relaxation techniques that help you get to sleep work for you, whether it's a golf swing or whether it's watching something on Netflix to decompress. It's what works for you, not what everyone else is doing.
Thank you so much for coming back on The Midpoint. Really appreciate it, Sarah. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Thanks. See you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Trevor, when you, we talked about you as a 30-year-old and kind of your lifestyle and how you are now, what about being a dad in midlife and the responsibilities? Because you, by the sounds of it, your lifestyle in your kind of 30s and 40s, you were busy, you were, you know, moving around, traveling around. Did that mean that during the day you got to spend more time with your kids that, say, other dads didn't?
No, it's a bit of a sore point with me because I didn't really. I mean, my daughter wasn't raised by me. She was raised by her mum. And my marriage was, which was 15 years, was with my son. And again, I weren't around much. Obviously, my wife at the time didn't work, so she was with him all the time. And I just assumed, I made that sort of assumption that if you're in a privileged position where your partner doesn't have to work, your kid, in a sense, is getting raised better because it's getting a full-on attention of a parent who's monitoring everything. But that parent has to be right, you know, and we have real, I have real difficulties. And the kids are a bit of a sore point for me because I don't think I ever had the chance to raise my kids the way I'd love to have raised them. And I think a lot of people who work the way I do or have been in that situation feel the same way. Gabby, my dog's returned. Can I get my dog in?
Yes, of course you can. Yeah.
Lisa's outside. Sorry. She just called me. And sorry. Oh, God. Give me a second.
All right.
Come on, Ollie. Say hello.
Oh.
Hello, Ollie.
Hello, Ollie. Oh.
Hello. All he cares about is his food, and I'm not going to feed him
now.
He's
so gorgeous. I think I've seen him on your social media or somewhere, and he's actually more handsome when he's 3D or 4D, whatever this is.
He is absolutely the best.
He's gorgeous. Oh, he looks very well groomed as well.
Yeah, he is.
He's very well groomed. He's lovely.
Go on, here you go.
And it's
his food. Sorry.
No, it's absolutely
right. Where do we get to?
We're talking about how you, maybe it is one of your regrets in life, and it is a time, midlife is a time, isn't it, where you start thinking about things you might have done differently. But you were just saying that you wish you kind of had maybe more input into the way your kids were brought up.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I wish, but at the same time, I look at it and I say, there's no way I would have really been able to do what I did. I know it's horrible to say it. And I know people love to say, I'll do anything for my kids. I'll do, you know, but when you're given the opportunity I had to do something that I was so passionate about, you know, you just have to see it through. You know, I thought I had a decent setup. It wasn't to be. We got divorced. It was tough. You know, it was really, divorce is really difficult. And I have lots of regrets. I mean, loads of regrets. But at the same time, I don't think I'd be here talking on this podcast about me being anybody, having had a career, if I did what idealistic people always say, which is, no, stop what you're doing. Go and do this. Go and do that. You know, in fairness to me, I didn't sit there and go, right, let's start a family and then do that. That it didn't work that way. And I would never have done that. I wish I started my family a little later when I had more time. Yeah, it's just not the ideal. It's not what I wish it could have been. That's what I mean.
It's very hard though, isn't it, to, you know, to get what is the ideal scenario. And you'll always have things that was it because you look back at the way you were brought up with your sisters and it was very different to that, I assume, obviously.
Very different. I mean,
How was your upbringing?
Parents were it. When what they said went, full stop. You know, there was no matter how much you might have fallen out with your mum or dad in your head mentally, oh, I hate you. You know, that sort of, you go through those stages of stop telling me what to do. The respect was enormous. Mm. If they said do something, it was done. If they said, you know, the respect, especially West Indian families, you know, it was just, that's how it was. Then another generation will tell you about your business. They'll just tell you about yourself. You know, they don't feel away. They'll sit there at dinner and go, yeah, that's because you're like this, aren't you? And you're just like, whoa. In my head, I think, boy, would I have said that to my mum or dad? No way. But they do. And I kind of don't mind it. You know, it is what it is. I think, you know, my kids are now, they're not kids. They're like 30 and 32. You know, they're not kids.
So, do they say things to you that you still wouldn't say to your parents?
Absolutely. Of course. I mean, I wouldn't say they're rude, but they're not afraid. You know, they're not afraid at all. And I think the world has changed. You know, you can't. I mean, I know people that, I mean, my old man, gosh, my relationship with my dad was just so different. You know, it was just so, oh my God. I didn't want to be in a car with my dad at times because he'd say, how's school? You know, those sort of moments when you go, oh, what, can we talk about the cricket or the football, Dad? No, how's school? You know, I'm just like, school's all right.
Did he ever turn around and tell you he was really proud of you? Did he ever tell you he was?
Took him a while because I was record mad. I didn't know I was going to work in the music industry. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was working in a shoe shop. And, you know, my dad always said I was his most intelligent child. I didn't go to university. I didn't get any A-levels. I got eight old GCSEs, you know, O-levels.
GCSEs, yeah, O-levels.
Yeah. GCSEs, yeah. I got eight of them. I should have gone on, but I didn't know anyone who went to uni, so I didn't go uni. It was a different time.
Was that a bit of a disappointment for him? Did he want you to go to uni? Did he want you to be the one that did?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember, he's the second wave of Windrush generation. They came here for something different for their kids and for their lives, you know, and they had to do jobs that were beneath them. My dad was a very bright man, but he was a bus conductor when he came. You know what I mean? And so they really looked focused on you doing well, but at the same time, they also understood that you had to get, you know, if you didn't go to university, get a job, have some idea of what you're doing, you know, get a trade. Because in those days, trades were the big, you know, YTS schemes and things like that, you know. Mm. You got a trade. Mm. Yeah, apprenticeships were huge if you didn't go to uni, and I didn't do either. I just loved music and I didn't want a job in music, but it's the only thing I showed true passion for. You know, my mum and dad really were worried about how many records I used to buy, how I was funding my hobby because it was so expensive. But then when Kiss FM got a license, I think we shared a bottle of champagne, and he said that's the first time he ever said, yeah. He said, well done. You know, he sort of said, it meant a lot. I didn't show it, but it meant a huge amount to me when he said, well done to me. Because, you know, I don't know. I just felt, you know, and they put me on the board of directors when I was 25 on KISS.
Wow.
I believe that. I was the only DJ on the board of directors. I don't know why people saw this in me. And I was like, what, really? Okay. And that's been my life, really. I've always waited for people to say, I think you should have this job, rather than me saying I want this job, you know.
It's kind of worked out well for you, though, that way of being, hasn't it? Even though you imply that perhaps you could have had more ambition for yourself at times.
Yeah, but I think I'm afraid of failure, Gabby. You know, I think if you're really honest with yourself, I think, and I'm being honest with you, I'm not one of those people who thinks I can do anything. I just think I never liked girls saying no to me. So I never asked them out. I'm one of those cowards, right? So anytime I felt I was out of my lane, I would be a coward and I would just not ask. I wouldn't ask for stuff. I'd wait to be noticed in everything in my life.
So your partner now, did she have to kind of trip you up and like, you know, but basically, hello, I'm here.
I think she did a little bit. I think she did a little bit. I mean, we've been seeing each other a long time, and like I said, we're finally tying the knot. So
better late than never.
Yeah, but it's, you know what? I feel the first time I did it, I made a big mistake. If I'm being honest, I rushed into it. I did something that, and no disrespect to my former wife, but I just on a whim kind of thing. I've done my due diligence now. And I realized, you know when someone's just right for you, and she's just right for me, so right for me, we get on. And
so when did you get engaged?
You ready for this?
Yeah.
7 years ago. In fact, we're in a restaurant. We got
what you're waiting for, just to make sure the 7 year itch wasn't a thing.
Well,
and then
we're in a restaurant and I proposed to her and she started crying, and I was trying to look cool and not flustered. And people around other tables are going, oh, he's a horrible man. Look at Ethan. Look at his girlfriend. She's distressed. He's not going over and sort of comforting her. He must be arguing with her. And I don't think it looked like a proposal. It looked more like an argument.
A happy moment. It looked like...
Yeah, yeah. But seven years ago. I know, a long time.
You know, we've kind of done this interview in reverse. I quite like it. We've kind of gone back to the start, and now we're finishing on what I think in midpoint history of 3 years doing this podcast, no midlifers have announced they're getting married very soon, which is great. I mean, you know, I might have to buy a hat. I mean, it's the first midpoint wedding that's coming up.
You're the first person I've told publicly.
Oh, wow. Well, we've got an exclusive.
Publicly.
I won't ask you where you're doing it, but I would imagine St. Lucia could be on the agenda. You never know. No? Okay.
Very quiet affair. For anyone who's listening to this podcast, by the way, if you're waiting for your invitation, don't worry. There's no need.
Right. It's a very small wedding.
It's sibling-ish. It's
right,
tiny.
Right, okay. It's tiny wedding.
But the joy is...
With great tracks.
If you have an honour, you can get married at St. Paul's Cathedral in a chapel.
Oh, okay. So that's Trevor Nelson MBE might be giving away the venue. Wow, that's amazing to think that, you know, kind of when you think about you back in Camden, right, just loving your music, to think that one day you get married in St. Paul's Cathedral, that's pretty special, isn't it?
That's pretty special, I think so. And, you know, and actually me, it's taken me to get to this point to be looking forward to an occasion like this, actually really looking forward to an occasion like this and wanting to do it. And the reason it took so long is because lots of people don't get married anymore. They're happy living together. And I just thought, I want it. And, you know, and I want it. It's about time I felt whole, you know, and did that thing that's really organically right for me at the right time. So it comes to you at a certain time in your life. I mean, I never thought I'd be pottering around my garden. Oh my God, it comes to everybody, doesn't it? I never thought I'd be loving a dog. I never thought I'd be keeping fish. I never thought I'd be playing golf. I never thought, you know, I'd go for a walk. It comes to it. I don't care who you are. it comes to you. And if it doesn't come to you, I feel sorry for you, because then you haven't lived. Because living is not just about a mad, frantic life, getting on planes, flying about, saying, oh, I've been to every country in the world. Have you been there? And it's not. You're missing the point. You high flyers, you manic people who run around like crazy, who think you're living life and everyone's jealous of you because you're Instagramming everything. Look at where I am today. You're actually not living life. Life is simple. And the simplest things in life. When I'm in a hotel miles away, all I want to do is come home.
Yeah. You always want to get to your own bed.
All I want to do is, I can't sleep in hotel beds.
Well,
I can't sleep on.
If you kind of distill what really you want in life, it's to always want to be home, isn't it? Because home should be somewhere you feel is the best place. So.
And my home is special to me. Very, very special.
You're winning on that, I think. And it's been so lovely to hear a lot of your story, but also your midlife story and how you've got to that place right now where things are good. And career-wise as well, I think as great as you would ever expect as a young DJ to be nearly 60 and to have a show that you've got now, playing the music you love, educating mm-hmm. people like me, I think is a great place to be, isn't it? And still there. With the mums and daughters on a Saturday night.
I think there is a thing about broadcasting, but when you stop trying to, I mean, I was never trying to be cool. Honestly, I was never trying. Everyone just gave me some cool tag because of the music I played, how I looked and all the rest of it. I've never tried to be cool, right? But I think when you get older, you're just yourself. You're just honest, you know, and also the chance to play music that I play Guilty Pleasures on that show, as you know, right? So I'll play some Elton, I'll play The Police, and the reason I'm mentioning all these soft rock acts is because I've always had my ear on them, you know. I'll play even Thin Lizzy, you know what I mean? I'll play anything with that unique soulfulness that I like, the Arctic Monkeys, you know. And it's beautiful because I've come from an era where they tell you what you can or cannot play. I don't mean songs, but...
No, but the playlist.
You can't play old music. Yeah. I've been on Radio 1 all those years, 17 years I was on Radio 1, couldn't play an old record, wasn't allowed to play Earth, Wind & Fire. I grew up on Earth, Wind & Fire. So Radio 2 has given me a second wind, and you can tell from listening to my show, I freaking love it. Yeah, I really do. Anyway, Gabby, great speaking to you. Cheers.
Thanks so much to Trevor. I love that he's enjoying life more on the cusp of 60 than he was when he was 30. And he's reaping the rewards of focusing on his own dreams instead of getting caught up in the ambitions of his peers. A lesson for all of us, I think, regardless of age. Catch Trevor playing the tunes he loves on Radio 2 Monday to Thursday from 10 o'clock and on BBC One Extra on a Sunday morning. And you can catch the special Windrush concert we mentioned, Windrush 75, as well on Radio 2 this Sunday, the 18th of June, or catch up anytime on BBC Sounds. A huge thanks to Sarah Gilchrist for her expert advice on sleep as well. Head to gilchristperformance.co.uk to find out more about Sarah's work. And thanks to Spiritland Productions for helping to put this episode together. But as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.